All right, good morning to everyone. Nice to see you all again.
I have a lung shot and I've also gotten a flu shot every year.
Okay.
And lung shot means every 5 years, I think.
Yeah. How what? How old? Right. How old was she married after Farish? How old was Esther? It's a very good question. The impression is that she's very young, but actually she was not. You see in Perek Beis that Ahasuerus violated the terms that he set out for his contest because he wanted young Naras Psulos, and Esther was an older married woman. So apparently he was taken with her in any event. But how old, what's that? Well, older than someone who was young and... I'll let you work it amongst yourselves. I don't want to get involved. Right. But it's a good question. We'll take it up next week. We'll look up Esther. What's that? Yeah, I guess so. Don't bring coffee, but we should meet. Right? Unless something comes up, I plan to have a shiur. Okay. I want to actually talk about Mordechai this morning. So start Perek Beis, Pasuk. Hey. Ishyudi hayav shushan abira. Ishyudi, a Jewish man or man of Yudah, was in Shushan Abira. So we understand that there are two phrases that are used in the Megillah. One is Shushan Abira, and the other is Va'ir Shushan, a distinction that we're familiar with today. Ir Shushan was a residential quarter. Shushan Abira was the governmental headquarters where people, in fact, did not necessarily live. It was a workplace. So Ishyudi hayav shushan abira shmo Mordechai, and his name was Mordechai, ben Yair, ben Shim'i, ben Kish, Ishyimini. Mordechai was the son of Yair, the son of Shim'i, the son of Kish, Ishyimini. That was Mordechai. Now let's look first at the phrase Ishyudi. Ishyudi means a man of Yudah. I'm not walking away for no reason. Ishyudi has a simple context and a more profound context. It's one of the very few times, by the way, you find in Tanakh, only here in Sefer Daniel, that anyone is referred to as a Jew, as Yudi, which became our name. Firstly, though, Ish always implies nobility. Vayhibi mei shvot ha-shoftim, at the very beginning of Megillas Rus, Elimelech is described as Ish as well. Ishnami means a person of nobility. I want to look at today, who was this person Mordechai? Why was he such a troublemaker? And how did the Jewish people relate to him? So Ishyudi, of course, puts him in a certain context as one of the nobility. Chazal say he was Miyoshvei Lishkas Hagozes, one of those who had in the past, when the Beis HaMikdash existed, sat in the Lishkas Hagozes, the chamber of the hewn stone, which was the seat of the Sanhedrin. He was one of the heads of the Sanhedrin. He was a member of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. So in fact, he was one of the leaders of the Jewish people. Ish. He was a leader that we'll see in a few moments, had very few followers. And as his story unfolds, he had an ever-diminishing band of followers. But nonetheless, he was also a Yehudi. But at the end of the Pasuk, he's described also as Ish Yemini. Yehudah means, Yehudi literally means he's from the tribe of Yehudah. Ish Yemini means he's from the tribe of Binyamin, which the rest of his pedigree would seem to indicate. Ben Yair, Ben Shim'i, Ben Kish. Kish, of course, was the father of Shaul HaMelech. So he's defined, Shaul HaMelech was from Shevet Binyamin, the tribe of Binyamin. So he's described, therefore, as a member of the tribe of Binyamin. So how could he be both? And what, in fact, does it really mean, Ishyudi? Ishyudi. So, in fact, Chazal say Megillah, Daf Yud Beis Amud Beis, and Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, a number of definitions. Why both are used? First, the Gemara says, Ishyemini, my Kamar, Ili Yichusa Ka'ote, if its common teacher is Yichus, then lichase v'azah binyamin. Why do they stop then at Kish? Why not go all the way back to Binyamin? Elamayshna hanitana kulan al shmo nikru. So it's designed to teach us that they're all called after his name. These were not only his ancestors, but he embodied the definition of their names. Ben Yair, Ben Sheheir, Einayim Shel Yisrael B'Tfilaso. He was the son of one, he was our son, a child of the Jewish people, who illuminated the eyes of Israel in his tfilas. Ben Shimi, Ben Sheshamael Tfilaso, a son of Kal Yisrael, whose tfilas were heard by God. Ben Kish, Shikish al Sharei Rachamim V'Niftechulo. He banged on the gates of mercy and they were opened for him. Because it was Mordechai's tfilas, Mordechai and Esther's tfilas, as well as the people's, that turned the tide, but it really was Mordechai and Esther were the catalysts. All right, now the Gemara takes up our point. Kori la Yehudi, the Pasuk calls him Yehudi, Alma Yehuda Kate. We see from here, he's from Shevet Yehuda. But for Kori la Yemini, he's also called Yemini, Binyamin is Benyamin, Alma mi Binyamin Kate. So that could be both. How could it be both from Yehuda and Binyamin? Omar of Nachman, Mordechai, Muchtar bin Imuso Hoya. Mordechai was crowned with names, crowned with a variety of names. Each name, each designation showed a different aspect of his personality. And now the Gemara discusses. Omar Rabba bar Avchana, Omar Yeshua ben Levi. Oviv mi Binyamin, v'imo mi Yehuda. His father was a Benjaminite. And his mother was from the tribe of Yehudah. So he's both. He's Ish Yemini and he's Ish Yehudah. The Rabbanan Amre, Rabbanan explained that Mishpachot Mizgaro Zo Bezo. Really, he was from both tribes, but both tribes warred over his ancestry. Who had the greater Yichus? Which I guess you find in different families today also. But here for a different reason. Mishpachas Yehuda Meres, the tribe of Yehuda would say, Ana Garim de Mishilid Mordechai. We are responsible for Mordechai's existence. To Lokatle David Lashimi Ben Gera. Because David did not kill Shimi Ben Gera, who was his ancestor, Ben Shimi, ancestor Mordechai. That story we'll take up tonight in the Novi. But suffice it to say, David had an opportunity and grounds, justifiable grounds, to kill Shimi ben Gera. He didn't. And as a result of that, Shimi ben Gera fathered the ancestor of the person who became Mordechai. U'mishpachas Binyamin amra, minay kasi. And Binyamin's, the tribe of Binyamin would say, no, he comes from us. He's Ish Yemini, he's one of ours. So Yehuda claimed credit because had not David allowed Shimi to live, so Mordechai would not have come into existence. And Binyamin can claim credit because he was a Benjaminite. Now the Rabbanon say that each side was claiming credit for Mordechai in their own way. Alright? Of course we know Jews cannot be completely positive. So the Gemara continues, Rav Amar Knes Yisrael Amro Le'idoch Gisa. The Knes Yisrael, the Rabbanon was saying one thing. Who's going to claim credit for Mordechai? The Jews had a different approach. Who can we blame for Mordechai's existence? Because they said, Re'u ma osa li Yehudi, u'ma shilem li Yemini. Look what this Yehudi did for me, and look what this Yemini did for me. What did the Yehudi do? Ma osa li Yehudi, delo katle David l'shimi. David did not kill Shimi. De isyaled minei Mordechai. And therefore Mordechai came into existence. Demikane Behamon. Mordechai was the one who aroused the enmity, the hatred of Haman. Is this a pro-Mordechai statement or an anti-Mordechai statement? It's an anti-Mordechai statement. That David should have killed Shimi. Because had David killed Shimi, Mordechai would not have come into existence. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. He seemed to have been the catalyst for all the sorrows. So who needs him? Knesset Yisrael says.
Were they saying this before the end of the story, or after the whole thing was over and had a happy ending?
You would think so. All right, well, We'll see just how much. That's the subject of today's shiur. Appreciation of Mordechai. Pro and con. So Knesset Yisrael says, yeah, he's a Yehudi. Who needs him? Because had David killed Shimei, we wouldn't have had all the tsars with Haman, because no one would have antagonized him. Ooh, mashilim liyamini. And look what this Yamini did. Who's the Yamini? The lokatle Shaul Agag. That Shaul did not kill Agag. The isilad mine Haman, the mitzali Yisrael. Shaul didn't kill Agag. Agag was the ancestor of Haman. Haman tried to kill the Jewish people. So in fact, Knesset Yisrael has a much more, a cynical take on the story. If only David had killed Shimei, we wouldn't have had Mordechai and his obstinacy, which caused all the tzaros. And if only Shaul had killed Agag, we wouldn't have had Haman. So we'd have no tzaros, we had no Megillas Esther, life would go merrily on. So essentially, the Gemara is saying, a pox on both their houses. Ishudi, Ishimini, there's no good from either of them. Which Rabbi Yochanan says, something that we appreciate in our day, and something which became part of our personality. Rabbi Yochanan said, La'ola mi Binyamin kate. He was really a child of Binyamin. We recognize that. Amai kari la Yehudi. Why is he called Yehudi? Al shum shekofar b'vodazoro. Because he renounced idolatry. Shekola kofar b'vodazoro, nikra Yehudi. Anybody who renounces idolatry is a Jew. And that's our name. So granted, I would say, in a philological context or etymological context, we would say we're Yehudim because most Jews today outside Shevet Levi are from the tribe of Yehuda and a smattering of Binyamin. The 10 tribes were scattered. So that's why we became Yehudim. But there's a broader reason, the Gemara says. It means a person who's Modeh b'Torah. Yehuda milashon hoda. A person who's Modeh b'Torah, who accepts the Torah, acknowledges the Torah, and therefore, by definition, renounces idolatry, such a person is a Yehudi. And that's what we call ourselves Jews today. So, in fact, this business of Mordechai refusing to bow down to Haman was not uncontroversial, either before it happened, when it happened, and after it happened. So let's see exactly those psukim and try to get an insight into Mordechai's greatness and maybe some lessons about Jewish life generally. So let's turn now to Perek Gimel, Pasuk Aleph. Achar Hadver Ma'ila, after we learn about Mordechai and after Esther's selection and she's elevated to queenhood and after the incident of Bigson and Seresh, which plays a role later in the story, Mordechai tells Esther, she tells Achashverosh, and it's duly recorded. After all this, really years later, it's 9 years later, Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh as Haman ben Hamdoso Agogi v'yanasehu. Achashverosh elevates Haman to be his viceroy. V'yosem es kiso me'al kol aser mesherit. He becomes the prime minister. His seat is above all others. He is the head of government. Now, apparently Ahasuerus did not object to what Haman's about to do, because as a king feels, or a head of state feels, you show honor to the other ministers, you're honoring the king. So v'cha avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech karim mishtachavim le'amon, yichein tziva lo ha-melech. All the servants of the king who were in the king's gate, they would prostrate and bow themselves to Haman, yichein tziva lo ha-melech, because that is what the king commanded. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai would not bend, he would not bow. Kriya is bending the knees, falling on your knees, and yishtachavoya is prostrating oneself. He didn't do it, despite the tzivoy of the king. Vayomrav de'amelech asher b'shar melech l'mordechai. So the servants of the king, who were the gate of the king, which were Mordechai sat as well, as we see from the story of Bigson and Seresh. Why do you violate the law of the king? So it's not just some personal deference to Haman that is now obligatory in the kingdom. It's Tzivoy HaMelech. It's the king's command to bow down to the to Haman. So they would ask him. Notice he didn't really answer. The Megillah doesn't record an answer. He just didn't do it. until it happened on a recurrent basis. Vayehi kamram elov yom vayom below shomai lehem. Day after day, they would pester him. Why don't you bow down? What's the big deal? Bow down. You can even laugh about it afterwards. But he wasn't. One of these Eastern kings that needs this type of obsequiousness in his subjects. No, lo shomai lehem. He did not listen to them. Vayagidu lehaman liros hayamdu devrei Mordechai. And they told Haman, and Haman then took an interest as well. Who is this fellow? Who is this person? Now, of course, Chazal say that they knew each other from the past. They were young people together and had run-ins before. But nonetheless, everyone wanted to see Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai. Would Mordechai's word, or would his position, be able to withstand Haman's ire? Ki higid lohem asher hu Yehudi. Because he had told them that he's a Jew. In other words, Mordechai then finally reveals that his reluctance to bow, his refusal to bow down to Haman is not just because he doesn't like Haman, which in fact he didn't, but because he is a Yehudi. Asher hu Yehudi. And indeed, ish Yehudi, hayo, b'shushan abiro. We see it again. Mordechai refuses to bow for one reason. Because he is a Yehudi. Vayar Haman ki Mordechai kor mishtachav elo. Haman now sees this. He's not bowing to him. Vayimalei Haman chaymo. He's filled with wrath. Vayivez beinav l'shloch yod Mordechai levado. And it became, it was beneath him really to attack Mordechai alone. Ki yidu osam Mordechai. They told him that Mordechai was part of the people. And he was not bowing down to Haman because this was a doctrine of his people. So then Haman, which is quite a leap, of course, and we've discussed this in past years, but Haman then endeavors to exterminate all the Jews who are Malchus Achashverosh because they're Am Mordechai. And he chooses a particular day, which happened to be 11 months later, Yud Gimel Adar, and the rest of the story unfolds. Yes. All right, so let's see. Why did... Okay. Yes, that's true. People did bow down. I'm glad you asked. That's a good question. So why did Mordechai not bow? The Medrash says, V'chikantron haya, v'over mitzvah, v'agzeres ha-melech, was Mordechai some obstinate, stubborn fool that he's not going to obey the king? Something so trivial? When Achashverosh commanded that people bow down to Haman, what Haman did was he engraved a certain idol and he put it on his heart and he intended people to bow down to the idol. That's what the Medrash says. Now the Gemara says in two places, the Tor Tamima quotes it here, two places, Megillah Daf Yotefim and Aleph, Sanhedrin, Sanach Aleph Amid Beis, that She'osa Haman Atzmo Eloah. Haman made himself into a god. Not that he had an idol that he carried with him. This is what they teach the children. But rather, Haman made himself into a divinity. Now, the Torah Tamima explains very insightfully, Sarach Ber L'chave Inyan Zeh B'chlal. We have to understand, we have to analyze what this really means. What's the difference between carrying an idol or making oneself into an idol? So he says, "Dakavona he, sheratza haman leharos, shavados kochav in moser lo koach, sheyehehu mashpil of neodam tzarchaya." Haman maintained that his idol, his religion, had given to him the power to bestow sustenance and goodness upon all his subjects. That's what it means. In other words, we say it in our parlance. Here you have a politician who's claiming divine, not divine power, but almost the divine, what we, they called in medieval times the divine right of kings. That, what's that? Because he was, he was deferential to Achashverosh. That's why. Achashverosh is a bigger god. You live, it's a pluralistic world. He's a bigger god. So Haman was always very careful to be deferential to Ahasuerus, very, very careful. The Haraya, the one time he was not, right? Hagam l'chvash malkaini babayis, when he fell on Esther's bed, the one time he wasn't careful, he lost his head over it. So he was very deferential to Ahasuerus. Yes. That's good. Well, that's good. Very good. When he said who would the king want to honor, right? The mechafes bikaro, he should wear levush malchus and kesher malchus and the susa malchus, and then Achashverosh already was his antennae were raised, and then when he saw Esther and Haman, then Haman was killed right away. So when he misstepped, that's when he was killed. But until then, very deferential. As a matter of fact, when he presents the plant to Ahasuerus, he sweetens the deal, gives a lot of money to Ahasuerus for it. And because he realizes that ultimately the decision maker is Ahasuerus. Nonetheless, it's really no contradiction to a person who has someone over him, right, and yet thinks that God is on his side. And he is only implementing God's will in the world. So that's always very dangerous. In fact, he continues by saying, the Torah Timimo, Hula osal zeh chokak avodas koma libo, as a sign that he was now endowed with his divine power, he was God's choice to rule the most powerful kingdom in the world. That's why he carved the idol. Not that the idol was distinct from him, but the idol, the Torah Timimo says, merged with the personality of Haman. Loros kihu v'vodas kochovim chadhu. He and the idol, they're one. And that, of course, is always a very volatile, dangerous combination. When a person feels that God is in his pocket, because as a political leader especially, because then he's no longer subject to reason or to compromise or even to other opinions, because what you're doing has to be done. This is what God wants. Hence the concept in our world today of jihad. Jihad is a holy war. That's what God wants. It occurred to me when I was in Israel, just thinking in the area, that I've never seen, and I wanted to do a search, but I didn't have enough time. I've never seen a concept of a milchama kedoshah in Jewish life, in Jewish literature. I'll check to make sure. But you don't find those words together, a holy war. Lachemes mitzvah you have, lachemes rishus you have also. But the notion of war as a holy endeavor, I don't think we find that in all the literature. Milchama kedosha. What's that? That's an obligatory war. You're forced upon it. Milchamas mitzvah is not just a war for conquest or Yisrael, but your enemies attack you. It's milchamas mitzvah too. Mitzvah doesn't mean it's holy. Holy is a different context, a different connotation to it. We don't have that. What's that? Right. But the milcham itself is never defined as that. I could be wrong, but I don't recall seeing it. I'll check to see. We have ways of checking now that are very easy. I've never seen those two words together, Mechama Kadosha. What's that?
The internet.
Yeah, I'll check. If I'm wrong, I'll let you know. But it's because we have a different approach to it. Mechama might be a mitzvah.
People could look at our Hebrew Ta'ar as being on
Jihad. Besides you, who would do that? No, so again, Milchamas mitzvah is different. Because you're talking about, yes, but you're talking about the goal of the war. I'm not talking about the goal of the war. I'm talking about the process of war itself, with the institution of war. I don't know if we look at war as holy. It could be a mitzvah, but holy? I don't know if Talmud Torah is holy. I don't know if the war is holy. It may be incumbent. It may be mandatory. It may be obligatory, which is a mitzvah. But holy, it's a different realm entirely. That we don't find in our world. The Muslims, of course, have it. The Christians had it too. That's the notion of crusade. Crusade is literally holy war. That's what it is. We don't have such a concept. But Haman, like other leaders down to our day, there's no doubt our friend Ahmadinejad in Iran sees himself as a divinely ordained figure to bring the Muslim world back to its zenith, or whatever was its zenith at one time. It's a dangerous phenomenon, obviously, because it's very hard to stop someone who thinks he's invested with divine authority has the Bible behind him. I mean, Ahmadinejad is almost a cartoon character. Of course, Bugs Bunny doesn't have a nuclear weapon. It's a little different. So you have to take him seriously. But it's just a different way of looking at the world. That way, which now we're familiar with in the Middle East, in Iraq, for example, the precursor to that was Haman HaRasha. You don't find even Ahasuerus saw himself like that, but Haman did. And that was Mordechai's reluctance. But, and now you have a big but, and we come to the main topic. What gives Mordechai the right to make this decision on his own? How dare Mordechai? In the Chuvas of the Radvaz, which Rav Avinir quotes, the Radvaz asks this question, by what right does Mordechai have to endanger all Klal Yisrael? They're all bowing. Everyone else is bowing. Why? Because Allah is, and this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, now Samach Alvin base takes up, what if a person is over with a Zar Miyiro, from fear? Not because he believes in God, but he's threatened. And the question is whether Hashtachavoya, bowing in fact, is in fact worship or not. It's a whole question entirely. So we pass like Rava, it's Patur. Avodah Miyiro is Patur. Yira means you're just afraid of the person, but you're not showing any deference or obeisance or worship to the idol itself. See, patur. So you want to risk your own life, it's one thing. But how do you risk the life of the people? What gave Mordechai the right to do that? Now, this is a very powerful and very important question, which comes up quite frequently, not only today, but even in generations past. Does one person have the right to make decisions that will potentially endanger others? Now, the obvious problem that we have is hindsight is always perfect, right? Hindsight is 20/20 vision. Hindsight is perfect. Our foresight is less so. So in the words of the Medrash, which Rav Avinir quotes, even before the Gezerah, the people tried to prevail upon Mordechai to come to his senses, saying, Teheyodea sh'atah michalenu b'cherav osa rasha. You should know you're going to cause us to be destroyed by this Russia's sword. Keep that in mind. You don't want to bow, but at the end of the day, you're going to wind up killing us. And in fact, they were correct. Haman came right away and said, I'm Mordechai. We have only one choice. Lashminis kol hayudim. I'm Mordechai. This is people. I'll get rid of all of them. So after the Gezerah, what happened? And this, by the way, is already implicit in the Gemara Megillah that I quoted. Mordechai became a pariah. People begged him to bow down to Haman. Refused. More than that, the Medrash says, people beg Mordechai, walk another way. Don't pass him. Don't walk by him. No. Every day, Mordechai would walk by Ahasuerus, walk by Haman, rather, to show Haman that he's not bowing down to him. Mordechai went out of his way to antagonize Haman. So much so, that a very interesting locution used in the Pasuk, who Mordechai, whether the in Pasuk Beis, everybody's commanded, Kar Mishtachavim Lehaman, Gichain Tzivil HaMelech, U Mordechai, Lo Yichrav Lo Yishtachavim. What's unusual about that? It's Lashon Asid. It's future tense, not present tense. The Pasuk should have said, U Mordechai Lo Koraya, Lo Mishtachavim. He's not bowing down. No, the Maral says, Lo Yichrav Lo Yishtachavim. Mordechai announced, to anyone who would want to listen, he is not bowing to Haman, and he will never bow to Haman. Wow. That is taking a lot upon himself. You could say you're not, but maybe someone will talk you into it. Maybe you'll see that the stakes are so great that fall to the floor, trip. In the language of the Medrash, actually it's the Medrash of Nebuchadnezzar and the seven sons, pretend you're tying a shoelace. All Mordechai, all Haman wanted to see was a little spine. Bend a little, just a little, that's all. A little bit. No, it's not all that Mordechai would not do it. He announced to everyone, Lo yichrav, lo echrav, lo eshtachaveh. I will never bend, never bow down to this Haman. Never will. So there are two issues that are raised. Firstly, something I mentioned in Shul a couple of weeks back, the Gemara in Brachos, I think it's Av Chesam it says, whether we are allowed to be misgare b'rishon ba'olam hazeh, whether we are allowed to antagonize evil people in our world. And the Gemara implies quite strongly that when Rishoyim are ascendant, so also Rizgaras Rishoyim Olam Hazeh. When a Rosh is on his way up, a powerful, he can't antagonize them, right? When the Rishoyim are powerful, not healthy to publish cartoons mocking their religion. Not healthy, because it just gets their anger up. So what do Chazal recommend? Keep a low profile. You have to be subservient. Look how Yaakov treated Esau when Esau returned and he was more powerful. Bowing, prostrating, offering tribute, gifts. That's Yaakov to Esau. Well, our recommendation always is, when the Rishon are powerful, you have to wait them out, however long it takes. It could take a year, could take 10 years, could take a century. Wait them out. Not fight. Also, Uzgars, Rishon Olam Hazeh, you have to wait them out. That's the traditional advice. And you see, in fact, it worked more or less. We're here today, so it worked more or less. We survived. No, it means you have to be very cautious in fighting. This, Rav Aviner said, became our approach in the exile. To some extent, the Haredi approach, ad hayom in Eretz Yisrael. Keep a low profile. Don't do everything. You don't settle there. You don't antagonize them. You don't respond to every provocation. Every provocation. Big danger. That's correct. So that was the advice in the exile. There was one dissenting voice, and that was? Well, besides him, we'll get back to him, Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. Bar Yochai, his treatment of the Romans. Bar Yochai said, no, mutu mazgaris bar sham volam hazeh. Well, so the Jews, then you're talking just the question of what's rational or not. Is it rational to confront a more powerful enemy? All right? You can make a very cogent argument. If you don't have the will to fight, or the will to see the war to its end, it's best not to get started. On the other hand, you can't... you have to make a rational move. You choose to fight. That's right. People question, you talk about the current war, people question whether the Western world has the will, the fortitude, the inner strength to see this war to its end as, say, the Western world did in 1939, 40, 41. Say 41, 42, 42 especially. I wasn't around then, some of you may remember, but it wasn't, I don't know how well known it was, and certainly the contrast between then and now, when Roosevelt declared, I think, after the Atlantic Conference, that the policy of the Allies would be unconditional surrender of Germany. Unconditional surrender. That left no room for negotiation. Now, I don't think today, in today's climate, such an attitude would work. If they said, no, we want abject capitulation, that's the only solution, there'd be very, very many voices, if not the majority, in the media and in the citizenry saying, whoa, one second. We're sending our young men to fight when the other side wants a compromise. They want to negotiate. What, are we out of our minds? Let's find a solution. So the cultural ties change, and people's attitudes towards war change, and their attitudes towards evil change. No doubt, it's become more pluralistic. Evil seems less and less evil. And you begin to make accommodations, and you lose the will, you lose the heart to fight. So it is a slippery slope. But the basic point is true. You have to know who you're fighting. There's no mystery to commit suicide. So if you're going to fight, you have to make sure you win. So also as garis b'rishon olam hazeh means you can't fight the losing battle. You can't provoke an enemy who's more powerful than you. That's true. Bar Yochai differed. Bar Yochai, the Rav Avinah tells a story from the Gemara Avodah Zarah, the Beis and the Beis, and the Gemara Shabbos as well. He had no hesitation to provoke Rome, to insult them, to criticize them. And in fact, when he was informed upon what happened, he had to flee. He lived in a cave for 13 years away from society, he and his son. But we could say that, obviously, what was his point? That even passivity in the face of evil is acceptance of the evil, and that can't be. So he was openly critical. It's a logical philosophy also. If you're going to win, if you're going to wind up in a cave, it may not be so so rational. But Rashbi was not like Mordechai in the sense that Rashbi only endangered himself. He was the one who was subject to Rome's wrath and sword. Mordechai endangered everybody. So how could that be? What was Mordechai looking at? That's one issue. The second issue, of course, and this plays a very important role throughout Jewish history, but especially now, is the role of preemptive attacks in such a circumstance. It's very perfect in hindsight. Now we see Mordechai lo yichrav lishtachaveh. That animated everybody. That sent a message to the generation. Of course, hindsight is perfect. In context, the people didn't see it like that. They thought Mordechai was out of his mind. He was a fabrenta, passionate, obstinate, crazy person, a religious fanatic, who, because he can't bend, he won't even violate the halacha necessarily. It's almost like personal pique. He doesn't like him, so he's going to kill all of us. Make no sense. But Mordechai launched a preemptive attack for another reason. We'll discuss in a moment. He saw the weakness of the generation and why he had to stand firm. The question still remains, did he have the right to launch his preemptive attack on his own? And we are very loath to do such things. Think about it. Rabbi Avinu has a very beautiful commentary on all of this. He said, Lu Yitzhu, the person who wrote a play or a book about this, let's say someone had killed Hitler in 1933. All right, what do you say? Matovu Manoim, right? Wrong, because 1933, Hitler may have been a Russia in word and in writing, wasn't quite yet a Russia indeed. So killing Hitler after he became Hitler is only proper or moral, so conventional thinking goes, if we know that he's going to kill millions of people. Until he does that, he's really not Hitler. The problem is, we can't live like that. So we look back and say, well, if only we knew then what we knew 12 years later, would it make perfect sense? How do we know we can't look at the world like that? So not to inflame too many people's passions, but you look at Baruch Goldstein. And if you look at, it's now 12 years this week, he killed all these people. Now his family claims he was averting a pogrom. All right? Now we would say, let's say the pogrom had happened, and dozens of the Jews were killed on Purim, and he could have done something to prevent it, and he didn't. Well, that's the hindsight that we're talking about. We have a discomfort, at least, with Baruch Goldstein, because we can't live in a world like that. And yet, that's exactly what Mordechai did. He took it upon himself to do an act which was so provocative, so out of touch with his generation, that he literally endangered everybody and set himself up for criticism. Criticism being castigated, cast out of acceptable society because he was just completely in dissonance with his generation. Now the problem, of course, always is when you try to act preemptively is you don't know what the future is going to hold. Let's say Hitler was killed. You could say maybe there'll be a worse Hitler. You know, people like stability, even the stability of evil. That's why America propped up so many dictatorships in the 70s and 80s. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Maybe there's someone worse. That's why people were in love with Arafat the last years of his life. We got to keep him alive, because who knows who'll come after him. And yet, people do live like that, because that's the devil you know as opposed to the devil you don't know. That's right. Well, see, he has one nice example he brings. In 1933, right after Hitler took over, so persecution started in Germany, the heads of the Reformed Jewish community in Germany wrote a letter to Hitler. Herr Hitler, we're being persecuted by these gangs, these goons, some of them from your party. We love Germany. Please use your influence with them to stop the persecution. It seems so naive to us. And yet, who are we to put ourselves in that position? Because we know the end of the story. I'll tell you something even funnier that he doesn't mention. The New York Times, in its editorial in March 1933, said, well, whatever Hitler said in the past, now that he's achieved the head of government in Germany, he'll have to moderate his views. Wow. When have you heard that recently? Right? Now that he's achieved power, so he can't try to implement the goals of Mein Kampf, it's insane. He's the head of a civilized country. Things have changed. Yes, Chizkiya Melech. Bahadei Kafir Rachman Alamalach. Chizkiya didn't want to have a child. I'll finish the story because he would be a Rasha, Menashe. Indeed, he was correct. Yishayahu criticized him, saying, Bahadei Kafir Rachman Alamalach. Who are you to get involved? God's secrets. We don't know the future. You can't know the future. He knew Ruach HaKodesh. It makes no difference. You have to live in the real world. Basher Husham. Basher Husham. That's right. It was Yishmael, it was dying. It's after Kriyas HaTorah on Rosh Hashanah, the first day. The angels plead with God, let him die, Yishmael, be such a tormentor of Jews. No, he's judged by Sher Husham. Now, is he tzaddik or Rasha? Now he's a tzaddik. Yet, what happened? The bottom line is we have to live in the world and we can't assume our foresight is accurate. On the other hand, what we give to have a little foresight and the ability to act. The point is, you see, when a person does act in a way which intends to be foresightful and anticipatory of future problems, he's lambasted for it because it is so out of the human character to be... fine, but it makes no difference. The people didn't see it like that. And you see in the Gemara, what do the people see? Look what this Yemini did for me. Look what this Yehudi did. Just antagonized Haman for no reason. So why did Mordechai do it then? Why did he do it? So granted, Ruach HaKodesh had a Sanhedrin. He was a leader of Kal Yisrael, a leader with no followers, which is not uncommon. Mordechai saw the weakness of the generation. He saw the weakness of the door. He was able to isolate the weakness of the door, and he therefore saw the slippery slope that would lead more and more to the loss of Jewish identity. He, alone of his generation, identified the enemy. Who was the enemy? Amalek. No one else saw it. Everyone else saw Haman, Prime Minister, Hashverosh, problem, this, that. He's negative. He's hostile. But he's Jacques Chirac. But Hitler, no. Mordechai saw the enemy. And he saw it in a very, very brilliant way. So he knew, of course, Haman's plan would be to destroy Klal Yisrael. That would be his plan when he took power. This whole business of Vayivakesh was just a pretext. Vayivez Beinov Lashlachin Mordechai Levado. Vayivakeshim Alashmus Klayudim was just a pretext. The bowing business was a pretext. He always wanted to kill all the Jews. That's why he came to power. Only Mordechai saw it. The problem was, it was a difficult sell to the rest of the generation. Rabbi Avinir writes that Amalek always arises to block our return to Eretz Yisrael. Very interesting pattern I never noticed before. When did we first encounter Amalek? Baderech b'teischem Mitzrayim. This week is Parshas Zohar. Amalek comes as we leave Egypt, go to Eretz Yisrael. Did Amalek have any tinies against us? No. We had no territorial claims against Amalek. They were Eretz HaNegev. We weren't being given the Negev at that time. It was just the southernmost point, as Yehuda, was north of the Negev. We had no claims against Amalek. No. They just want to kill Jews. Yes. Also true. That's right. Same thing here. That's right. But it's even more than that. So what's happening now? What's the context now? It's the beginning, right before the binyan of the second base of Mikdash. Jews are given permission to return to Eretz Yisrael. Who rise again? Amalek. And he says, in our generation, last century, Jews are again given the right to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Various Aliyah movements, the Balfour Declaration, who rises to prevent the Jews from returning and establishing a state? Hitler. It's Amalek again. Every time we start the march back to Eretz Yisrael, Amalek comes. It's the same thing. And you're right, Kol Nechash Shalim Acharecha, because that return is almost always accompanied by some attenuation in Jewish identity. That's what Mordechai saw. So Mordechai reinforced Jewish identity and Jewish pride as a Yehudi. Gigid lohem asher hu Yehudi, is Yehudi? By not bowing. Because bowing would presuppose the recognition of another power. Vanachnu! Korum mishtachavim lemelech malchem elachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We bow, but only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's it. To no one else. So Mi'ikra Din, could he have done it? Mi'ikra Din, he could have done it. Why didn't he do it? Because he saw he was the bulwark against the Jews completely assimilating and completely falling under the sway of Haman, of Amalek, and then Amalek would have the upper hand and we'd have no chance to survive. Sometimes it takes one person, very difficult for that person, it takes one person to stand against the generation. Now we tell, Rav Avinet told a very interesting story. I picked this up last week in Israel, by the way. It only came out last year. Very interesting story. When the Pope, when Paul VI visited Israel in 1964, so he says that very excited and nervous, of course, anxious, because the Vatican did not recognize Israel at the time. And Rav Yitzhak Nissim Zatzal was the chief rabbi, the only chief rabbi at the time. So Herzog had died and now he had been replaced. He refused to go. Refused. He said, if the Pope wants to come, we're a sovereign country, I will host him very honorably at Heichal Shlomo, but I'm not going to go out to him any more than if I came to the Vatican, he would go out to see me. I have to come to him. He's here, let him come to me. And he was lambasted. And Rav Avinier writes that eventually the Pope came, and if you remember, I was a little kid at the time, but if you remember, he came in a very sort of, you remember very well, but... right. He came in a very sort of understated way. Came from, didn't want to come through Yerushalayim, came from Megiddo, and then down the coast, and up the road one through Yerushalayim, and there he was greeted. And Rav Avinah writes, he writes it in his parish here, that he just walked by everybody. And he didn't pay any attention to the Knesset members, the dignitaries, just walked through. This he doesn't write, but it's true, he refused to spend the night in Israel. He came 9 in the morning, left 9:40 at night through the Mandelbaum Gate, back to the Old City, back to Jordan. He refused to sleep a night in Israel. And he says, he writes that Rav Nissim was vindicated. That people saw, here's pride. Rav Nissim was like Mordechai, lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. He was the only one, alright? So I had no idea one way or the other, but I tried to do my research. So I looked it up. In my front page of the Jerusalem Post, in its first 50 years, and it's interesting that he has the facts wrong. Alright? Now why this we'll discuss in a second, but it's January 6, 1964, there's a whole article, the front page. Pope Paul, relaxed and happy, spends unforgettable day as pilgrim in Israel. And you see a picture, it's funny, he writes, he refused to greet the president, the prime minister, the picture of Shazar, President Shazar, standing next to him with Prime Minister Eshkol, all the ministers were there, the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim came out, all right? Everybody was there. All right, he said what he said, he defended Pius the 12th, whatever. He spent his few hours in Yerushalayim, and then he just went on his way. All right? What Rav Avinah remembers as vindication for Rav Nissim is in fact not so, at least in this context, because the Jerusalem Post editorializes. Shame on Rav Nissim. It is seems, the, and they're very positive. He's a very forward-looking pontiff. We know him as a Jew-hater now, but they're very filled with praise of Paul the VI and what he's done. Thanks for coming, you know. Bending over backwards. It seems the more regrettable that Chief Rabbi Nissim should have chosen not to express the greetings of his own high office, the nation's guest. In most matters, a chief rabbi must be his own authority. And had he declined to do so on some grounds of religious scruple, it might be felt as a decision that he must make for himself. But as what was involved was the place and form of the meeting, a mere question of prestige, his refusal was an unhappy one. All right? And that was the refusal. He said, he's here? I'm come to Echa Shlomo. Why should I go to him? Just like in the reverse would be the same thing. And they say, by this withdrawal, Chief Rabbi Nissim has in fact placed a division between the religious and lay representatives of the state. Division is not good. And they say, Rabbi Nissim has scarcely set the right example by what he did. Well, what's with Rabbi Avinier? So the answer is, of course, that memory is always shaped by attitudes. And there's no doubt in the religious world, I'm not sure Rabbi Avinier lived in Israel at the time. I think he grew up in France. But attitudes always shape memory also. And he could remember that in the religious world, there was a tremendous outpouring of support for Rav Nissim for what he did. The fact is that what he did, lo yichav le'ishtachaveh, is at least similar in some sense to what Mordechai did. We're not going to prostrate ourselves to them. If we're a sovereign state, then he'll be greeted as the head of state, which the Vatican, which the Pope is head of the Vatican. He should be no different than anybody else. Come to the Knesset. Come to the president's house. Come, be hosted. Be feeded even. You are a spiritual leader too? So come to greet the Rabbanim Hechel Shlomo. You know better than anyone else. No. It didn't play well with the door. Our memory is such because our memory is influenced by Mordechai and the example of Mordechai. But you see, even what Rav Nissim did, what Rav Avinier extols, the society, at least through the prism of the Jerusalem Post, was really not that laudatory. There must have been a division at the time between how the religious world and how the secular world in Israel even viewed such a visit. No doubt Mordechai was hounded and harassed and tormented and ridiculed by those who had very little hindsight and almost no foresight. But that's the great person of the generation. That's the Ish. The issue D, the leader, the one who has to set the tone, the one who has to act, the one who has to lead and make decisions, and then it's Biyad Hashem. Even the great Mordechai, tremendous hero to us today, as Megillah says at in the very last pasuk, V'ratzui L'rov Echov. Most people liked him after what happened. Ratzui L'rov Echov, the Gemara says Megillah Daf Tezayin Bez. Not everybody liked him. Why? Because what he did was controversial. And people resented him, and the Sanhedrin didn't like the fact that he stopped learning Torah, went to government. Everybody has own complaints about everyone. That's Jewish life. He's Ratzi L'rov Echov, which is also pretty good. So that's how they saw him at the time. What does history say? Shoshanas Yaakov. Baruch Mordechai HaYehudi. Mordechai was a true Jew. The true Jew sets the example for Doros, and that's why he's Baruch forever and ever. Thank you very much.
Thank you.